Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Scott Lake for Appellants Western Watersheds Project and Center for Biological Diversity. I'm going to try to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll keep my eye on the clock. Your Honors, this case is an environmental case involving a public land management project, but I think most fundamentally, this case is really about government accountability. We're here because in authorizing a large, lengthy, expansive, and ultimately very expensive project, the government violated two statutes that Congress enacted to bring regularity, transparency, and accountability to the administrative process. Those statutes are the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. The basic purpose of NEPA is to ensure that government agencies and those affected by the government's decisions are fully informed about the environmental consequences of those decisions. And the other statute at issue here is the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, or FLPMA, which requires the government to follow a structured sequential planning process for public land management. Because of its failure to adhere to these two statutes, the government's decision is not reasonably explained and must therefore be set aside. We're asking this court to reverse the district court's decision and vacate the underlying Bureau of Land Management decision at issue. Unless the court has questions, I'd like to start with the NEPA violations and then I'll move on to the FLPMA issues. The basic issue under NEPA here is that the project's environmental assessment, or EA, is far too vague to fulfill NEPA's basic purposes. And before we get into the specifics of that, I'd just like to mention a few facts about the project that provide some context here. First of all, this project is massive. The total project area, if you just draw a circle around the boundary in which the government plans to conduct all these different activities, is about 650,000 acres. To give some perspective on that, that's about six times the size of the cities of Reno and Sparks, or about two times the size of Lake Tahoe Basin. Within this area, the government has failed entirely to explain where, when, and how various activities are going to take place over a period of 10 to 15 years.
It seems to me that a thread going through this case is your discomfort or disagreement with the concept of adaptive management. Can you address that point?
Yes, Your Honor. The plaintiffs in this case don't have any kind of disagreement with the concept of adaptive management, and particularly how adaptive management has been upheld by this court in past cases. The problem with this particular environmental document is that the government simply invokes the concept of adaptive management and doesn't articulate any actual adaptive management plan. So we discuss this in our briefing, but there are several definitions of adaptive management in the administrative record. One definition of this is from the governing land use plan, the ELE-RMP, at two excerpts of record, 209 to 10. And in that passage, the plan explains that adaptive management is a formal systemic approach involving specific, measurable, and achievable objectives and definite timeframes. To the extent that this environmental document, this EA, articulates an adaptive management approach, which we do not believe it does, it involves none of these things. There is no formal systemic approach. Instead, we have repeated statements that any treatment could occur in any unit. That means anything could happen anywhere at any time.
Well, not quite. I mean, the agency does specify this is our preferred course of action in specific circumstances or specific units, and then says that, you know, depending on how things go or, you know, changes to the environment or other changes, we have some alternatives that we might consider. Why is that bad?
Your Honor, the problem is that in the government doesn't articulate, the EA never articulates the circumstances which would prompt those changes. Basically, all the EA sets out is that there's going to be some ad hoc determination in the future outside of public review that's not going to be disclosed to either you know, the executive decision makers or the public. And the government's going to make a decision on what to do on the land based on what it finds out there.
I thought that they took this area and divided it into 13 units, and that the total treatment would cover 19% of the total area, not all 650,000 acres. And they outlined four different things that could happen: chaining, mowing, herbicides, and controlled burns, right? Outlined the environmental assessment of what each of these things, how each of these things would occur generally for the whole project. But I thought your objection was that they didn't say parcel by parcel, unit by unit, this is how each one of these things could play out, and that it was just too generalized because it was the whole project.
Yes, Your Honor. The objection is that anything could happen in any unit, and any combination of things could happen in any unit.
Didn't they identify the preferred approach to each unit? I thought that they did. And then fall back, these are other options, things that could happen depending on how things unfold, but a controlled burn is not one of those things that can just happen. There has to be a specific, some specific work that happens before then.
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. The first is that the statement, and again, there are multiple statements in the EA to this effect, that anything could happen anywhere, makes this delineation of units and designation of preferred treatments meaningless. The other issue is that to the extent that there is, you know, some kind of adaptation implied here, the government never articulates the circumstances, you know, what's going to prompt that adaptation? How is it going to, you know, what kind of things are we going to look at? What kind of things are going to trigger us to say, hey, maybe we should do something different here? That is never articulated. We not only have to guess at what treatment's going to be conducted, but we have to guess at what criteria the government's going to use to change that initial preferred treatment determination. And I should also mention that within the range of even those preferred treatments, the things that they contemplate happening have vastly different impacts. And again, the point of this EA is to evaluate environmental impacts. So within a single unit, the preferred treatments could cover anything from selective hand cutting, where agency personnel walk out there with chainsaws and cut a few trees down, to chaining, where they're mowing down entire stands of trees using an anchor chain from a Navy battleship, uprooting whole trees, leaving a lot of bare soil, leaving the place essentially torn completely up. Those obviously have vastly different environmental impacts, and the problem is that if you say, well, either this or that could happen, we don't really know, and furthermore, we're not going to articulate any criteria for determining what happens where. It doesn't give any informative picture of the environmental impacts of the project. So, you know, for example, we have two standing declarants in this case who are members of our organizations. And, you know, one of them, Delaine Spilsbury, has a few favorite hunting spots in Spring Valley. And if Delaine were to read this EA and say, I want to know if, you know, how this project is going to affect my hunting spots. Am I going to be successful this year? Do I have to move on? You know, do I have to go someplace else? She wouldn't be able to tell. She wouldn't be able to tell if they would be treated. She wouldn't be able to tell how they would be treated. And we're not asking for an ultra-specific, like, these are the specific trees we're going to cut down delineation here. But basically, the government has to give some indication as to where, when, and how it's going to do this. This court has frequently reiterated that point, and I think...
Well, that's why I started with this question about adaptive management, because I think that the government, the way I understand this plan, is we've identified these units, we've identified our preferred course of action for these units, we've identified some alternatives, and recognized that this is not going to all happen in the course of a year or a course of a few months. It's going to happen over a longer period of time, and things in the environment could change that would make us would make it appropriate to adjust our course. And so we're going to build in that flexibility and let people know that we're building in that flexibility. That seems to me, at least theoretically, to be an appropriate way to think about a project that's going to extend over a significant area and a significant amount of time. And as I read your objections to this, it seems to come back to me, it seems to come back to sort of a fundamental disagreement with the idea of an adaptive management, the idea of, you know, sort of a structure of a plan with built-in flexibility, and that's what you don't like.
Your Honor, the objection here is to the lack of structure. If I could...
How is there a lack of structure when you have this unit designation and you do have a specification of a preferred, this is our first choice, this is what we're going to do unless there's a reason not to? That seems to be a structure.
The government never articulates what that reason not to could be. It could be anything. It could be, there's absolutely no guidance in the EA as to what that reason not to would be. All we have is any treatment could happen in any unit. We have, so it makes this delineation.
Is there a particular language in the EA that you can put, I mean, you've said this multiple times, that they could do anything, anywhere, anytime. And while I concede that this is clearly written with you know, a fair amount of flexibility in there, I think that's an overstatement. So what is the language in the EA that you would cite me to say that that's what they're saying? We can do anything we want, anytime.
Your Honor, it's... I don't appear to have it in my notes. It is cited in the briefing. There are three instances within the EA where the government says any treatment or combination of treatments could occur in any unit. It's at the bottom of the table that lays out preferred treatment units. It's in the appendix describing the adaptive management plan to the extent that there is an adaptive management plan. And there's a third statement in there that I'm not precisely sure about where it occurs, but there are certainly three statements in there where the government says, we've laid out this structure, but we don't have to follow it. And that's the problem. Where this court has upheld adaptive management and says, yes, this is consistent with an agency's NEPA obligations, there is a far more structure imposed on the agency's adaptive process than there is here. For example, in the Klamath-Siskiyou Wildland Center case, this District of Oregon 2013, first of all, you have a much smaller area. And I think that's something I'd like to touch on for a moment as well, because as you mentioned, this is a large, expansive project. And, you know, nothing prevents the agency from making broad-scale plans, and it can be a useful planning tool. The problem is this court has established in the California v. Block case that if the government lays out a large-scale plan and speaks in generalities about how that large-scale plan is going to play out, that's not the end of the process. The government has to look at the land, you know, the specific conditions at the site where it's going to conduct the treatment. And, you know, again, we're not talking about small areas. A single treatment under this project could be 2,000, 3,000 acres. So we're not asking you to go like acre by acre or even 10 acres by 10 acres. But
not asking us to do that because Cascadia Wildland says that's not the appropriate review.
Well, exactly, Your Honor. But even in Cascadia Wildlands, the court notes that there's some structure imposed on the adaptive management plan. And again, Cascadia Wildlands involved a much smaller project. So these projects that the government is talking about in its response could be a single treatment under this project. So again, the issue is not with the approach. The issue is that the government skipped a step, and it skipped arguably the most important step. So going back to the Klamath-Siskiyou Wildlands case, there you have a project that's 857 acres of treatments. That's less than a single treatment under this project. That plan included what the court characterized as clear, qualified metrics, including a rating system that the government would adhere to. So instead of vaguely saying, we're going to adapt, the government described how it was going to adapt. There are also well-defined constraints on how that adaptation would take place, as in no old growth, no, and they set a minimum canopy cover for the treated areas. You don't see anything like that here. The government's not giving the public any indication of what the adaptation would actually entail, like how are we going to carry this process out. The same goes for the Protect Our Communities case and the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership case. These describe the adaptation process in detail, and that's the element that's missing here. There's no formal or systemic approach. There's no specific or measurable objectives. The objectives consist of things like reduce tree cover, reduce sagebrush cover, How are we supposed to know when tree cover has been sufficiently reduced? How are we supposed to know when sagebrush cover has been sufficiently reduced? It's not like the government's incapable of making these determinations because they made them in the cases they themselves are citing. The problem is that the overall vagueness of the approach makes it not informative. And I just like to touch briefly on the Seven County decision here and say that, you know, the sideboard that decision sets and, you know, the direction that decision sets for a court's review of a NEPA analysis is the decision reasonably explained? And if the government can't articulate what it's going to do, where it's going to do it, or even the criteria it's going to use if it decides to change its mind, then the decision is simply not reasonably explained. I'm at about 4.5 minutes left, so unless the court has any further questions, I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Christopher Herr on behalf of the Department of the Interior. As counsel noted, this case involves the Bureau of Land Management's approval of watershed restoration project for the South Spring Valley and Hamlin Valley. This project is just one small part of BLM's larger and long-term effort to restore disappearing sagebrush communities in the Great Basin region. BLM also seeks to protect this land against large catastrophic wildfires, which are a consistent concern in this region. To meet these goals, among others, BLM considered various vegetation treatment options to reduce invasive plant species, to reduce fuels for fire, and to promote biodiversity. Those methods include things like hand cutting, mowing, or chaining, as was just discussed, and others include the limited use of herbicides, or if it's authorized at some point in the future, prescribed fire. All of these methods considered are nothing new and have been part of BLM's management of public lands for many years. As counsel noted, there's two primary claims here, both NEPA and FLIPMA. So I'll start with NEPA, unless the court has any questions at the outset. And first, I'd like to touch upon Seven County just a little bit. In the reply brief, plaintiffs say that Seven County was a mere reaffirmation of prior precedent, and that it just, you know, sets a sideboard, so to speak, of what reasonable review looks like for NEPA claims. But that's not exactly the case. In Seven County, the Supreme Court made a course correction for NEPA review that stresses substantial deference to agency decisions on how to craft its NEPA review, especially for decisions involving scientific judgments like this one. And as this court has grappled with post-Seven County, it's always possible to find a resource area or impact that might receive more detail in an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment. But the Supreme Court made clear that the question of whether any particular report, including the EA in this case, is detailed enough is an exercise of agency discretion. And that should.
I want to drill down on that a little bit. I mean, we had another case this week that had to do with NEPA, and both of them caused us to think about exactly what is left for us to do after Seven County. So, I mean, I think I read that decision to say to support at least part of what you're saying, which is that the agency has discretion to decide how to study a problem, you know, which scientists to choose, how many studies to engage in, how to think about those studies, which one to favor if you've got different ones suggesting different things. There's all kinds of deference there. But at some point, NEPA does have a requirement that's supposed to be met, which is informing the public about what the government is going to do. And this case seems to sort of get at where do these two things meet? Where do, yes, you have the deference to look at what you perceive to be a problem and try to figure out how to solve it and pick your own methods, and then also telling the public what you're going to do. And so, you know, your friend across the on the other side is saying it's not necessarily bad that you have chosen this adaptive process, but we don't even know what you're doing because you've left so much room to make a new decision at any point. And so how do we think about that in terms, at some point, if that was literally true, and I'm not sure it is, but if it was literally true, then wouldn't the goal of NEPA be undermined?
Well, yeah, I agree with you on the recitation of what NEPA requires, and I can appreciate the conundrum that the court might be in reviewing a project like this. And, you know, the cornerstone is, of course, reasonableness, as Seven Counties says. How that applies here, I think, is very context specific. For a watershed management restoration plan, you know, as we talked about in our brief, it takes place over a long period of time. It does involve a large number of acres, although it's a similar number of acreage to the Cave Valley and Lake Valley watershed restoration plan that this court affirmed in the Roos case. But the, you know, the BLM took great pains to sort of map out treatment areas, discuss some confines and goals and strategies within those treatment units, and then made clear that it was going to survey these areas both before, during, and after treatments to ensure that BLM is meeting its goals here. Because certainly, for example, for one hunting season, conditions might change significantly to another. And, you know, this project, because it takes place over a relatively large area over a long period of time with rapidly changing conditions, BLM had to find a solution to that problem. And what this court, I think, is left to do is decide, can it understand, was it reasonable what the agency was trying to do here? Can you see how the agency got there? Can you see how BLM structured its analysis? And I think to do that, and I believe Judge Beatty, you had asked about where that statement of you can do anything anywhere comes from, and that, you know, while we dispute the accuracy of the statement of my friend on the other side of the blank check that provides, the record, I think it's ER 33, contains language that just makes it clear that within the confines, within the tables and goals and treatment units and good faith efforts that BLM put forward to try to explain exactly how it was going to, you know, structure its restoration plan here, flexibility was required for on-the-ground conditions. So it's just, I think that's just an acknowledgement that, sure, there might be primary treatments, but secondary treatments might be necessary. Additional treatment might be necessary if invasive plant species.
So I'm not sure, and maybe it's both, but is the government's primary position that you have provided sufficient structure or you don't have to because it's a matter of discretion for you?
In this case, Your Honor, we're saying that we have, that under the circumstances, we provided enough structure for this court and the public, importantly, to understand what the agency's goals are, where it is looking to achieve these goals, and the types of conditions that have both led to it and the conditions that BLM hopes to achieve.
So can you address the specific critique that was raised by opposing counsel of, we have no idea, they've set out a preferred option and then some secondary options. We have no idea what's going to trigger them to change from one course to another or when they might do that. Can you respond to that? Like, what do we look at in the EA to know that that's wrong or what maybe you think that that's not a problem?
No, Your Honor, I think this is something that the EA does grapple with under the context of the specific plan, which is BLM needs to analyze what status that particular area is in, both in terms of, you know, there's three phases of encroachment. And we're talking about, you know, the targeted areas for treatment are where encroachment is an issue of woodlands into sagebrush communities. So it's first identify which of those phases are we talking about? What are the preferred options given the specifics, you know, both in terms of tree cover and encroachment that BLM will assess? And then, you know, using those treatments and surveying the area, you know, there are special species that exist in this, in some of the treatment areas, and to survey those areas and to understand, well, what type of habitat are we looking at? And make those decisions in real time. Now, we are talking about real-time decisions, Your Honor, so I can't say that there's a rubric of, you know, the if, then, and so on and so forth for every single acre here, and I don't think that would be reasonable. And that's what I think Seven County instructs, is that when the agency is making these types of judgments and this type of context, reason is the rule. And can we understand what the agency would be using in each decision point
Where would you point us in the EA to see that structure?
In the EA, yeah, it starts off at page 33 to 35, generally in the excerpts of record. And that just lays out, and it's also in Appendix E of the environmental assessment that talks about sort of the different treatments and how they're implemented here. And in several other areas that we mentioned in our brief in the EA. But it's keep in mind, we're also implementing through this project the Ely Resource Management Plan, you know, which these two watersheds exist within. So with all those things together, I think the public and this court, importantly, can understand how the agency is getting to, or how the agency is attempting to achieve its goals for these specific watersheds based on the problems identified. There's enough structure on those bones for the court to sort of identify what types of decisions are at issue and what types of treatments you would expect in different regions.
So when your opposing counsel says that the EA says repeatedly that anything could happen at any time in any area, that suggests that it's, and this may just be my understanding and not what was his intent to convey, that it could be anything even outside of the four types of treatment that are outlined in the EA. And I didn't read it like that. I thought that the EA was saying, here are the things we could do, chaining, mowing, herbicides, or controlled burn. But it wasn't like anything beyond those four things could happen. I'm not sure what other things could be used, but can you address that? I mean, how specific, that's what I'm struggling with. How specific is this EA and how specific does it have to be, I guess, which is the crux of the issue.
Right. Well, I mean, any statement regarding flexibility, I mean, the one that I pointed to on page 33 of the excerpts of record is within the context of those, you know, the phases and the management goals and talking about the treatment units. So it has to be read in this context, or that context, first and foremost. And then beyond that, I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor. You cannot, BLM does not intend to just sort of decide willy-nilly which types of treatments would be used. It's going off of this document. It's going off of the Ely Resource Management Plan. It's going off of the prior analysis that this agency has tiered to in terms of how to structure its treatments. And there's nothing in the EA, we would argue, that if it says any intent for BLM to sort of just have a free-for-all approach. Like I was saying at the outset, this is based on monitoring of conditions both before and after treatment to ensure that we're meeting those goals that we set out when BLM is conducting its work here over time.
I just have one factual thing I want to make sure I understand. I read the plan to say that if you're going to do the burning option, more work has to be done in terms of explaining that and making a plan for that. I don't understand that more work needs to be done if the other options are chosen beyond what's already laid out in the EA. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the burn plan would, or BLM would have to conduct a burn plan first and foremost before conducting prescribed burn. And in no way does this environmental assessment authorize the use of prescribed burn. That has to be done through a burn plan, as we note in our briefs. And yes, if the other treatments, and you know, while we can't look into a crystal ball over the long period of this project, it is, as I stand here today, unlikely that may be used. That is a decision that BLM would have to make, and then would have to comply with a burn plan and also NEPA in before doing so. But yes, to give a long-winded answer to a simple question, Your Honor, if the other treatments are being used, that would obviate the need for a burn plan if those were sufficient to meet the project's goals.
Right, and if we're 10 years down the road and this still is ongoing and you get to a new unit and you had previously said, you know, our primary option would be chaining, but now we've looked at this and things have changed and we're instead going to do herbicide or whatever, you're not going to do another, like, public announcement of that because under the government's view, you have laid out a structure in this EA sufficient to cover the need to change.
I think that's generally right, Your Honor, with the caveat that if there's, so long as future treatment based on the conditions changing fits within this plan, you know, there could be circumstances where conditions change so much that you know, the agency might consider at that point supplementation or something like that. That's always an option under NEPA. And I'm not suggesting it's something that would be required here, but that would have to be something the agency thinks about at that juncture.
And I guess maybe that gets to a point that Judge Beatty was asking about, is if you decided, because things have changed so much, that you need to go outside these four options that you've come up with, and that would be an example of where you'd need to supplement.
And if, well, my response to Judge Beatty was more if, you know, the EA sets up a menu of options and doesn't necessarily say that one is required to happen under certain conditions. It gives you what the expected treatments should be, what the primary choice is, and then maybe some secondary choices as well. And that would need to be flexible to adapt to, you know, let's say that, you know, the encroachment of woodlands was so interspersed that it would make, you know, a specific treatment maybe unreasonable or not feasible, not it's not about reasonableness at that point, not as feasible as others, then the agency would have to adapt there. But it would still be within that same menu of options listed in the EA. If the BLM was going to consider a treatment wholly outside of that, then I think we'd be more, that would be a more difficult question, Your Honor. Would supplementation be something required or not? But, you know, BLM was confident that the menu of choices listed in the EA and discussed in the EA are the ones that BLM is considering here.
Well, I like the menu analogy. That gives me something to hold on to. So one further question on that. I understand you to just have said that BLM's position is that it thinks it can live within the menu of options it has announced, and that if it at some point concludes that it needs to add options to this menu, maybe it will supplement?
Yeah, it would depend on the circumstances, Your Honor.
So it's not the government's position that if it decides new menu options need to be added, that it must supplement?
I'm just hesitant to sort of surmise what those, I mean, honestly, I don't know what other treatment options might be feasible here, because we have, you know, we're tiering off of the other resource management plans. So this is kind of the universe, so to speak. But let's say that we were going to come up with something entirely new, a new type of treatment that was just developed and it had substantially different environmental impacts. And that's the second piece, Your Honor, is, well, what are the impacts of that? You know, is this going to potentially be material to the agency's decision or not? You know, we'd have to go through the supplementation rubric. But certainly, if there are new treatment options that are not discussed in, you know, any of the prior NEPA or in this case, that would be something that the agency would have to consider. What decision it would make after that in terms of whether to supplement or not, I can't give you a firm answer at this point.
Well, that feeds a little bit into your friend across the aisle's comment about maybe the government can do anything it wants anytime, anywhere.
And that's just not the case, Your Honor. I mean, again, I'm harping on the context of the way BLM discussed its treatment options here and, you know, did set up guidelines, which have been in place for quite some time. You know, this is not sort of some new goal that BLM has put forward. This is part of its adaptive management plan for the Ely district, and it's discussed in other prior NEPA analyses. So, you know, BLM is absolutely considering all of the factors that it goes through for these watersheds and has come up with, you know, this type of analysis, and we think that would hold under a variety of circumstances the EA discusses.
So let me see if I understand what you're describing. BLM is trying to reduce the incursion of particular trees, restoring parts of this area to what it was before when it was mostly just sage. There are concerns about the impacts on various species, birds, bats, presumably rodents, other things that live there. And when you clear brush and trees, it's usually done in certain ways that are outlined in this EA and in other projects. So for it to go outside of that, there have to be, well, now we're going to try water cannons or flooding the area or lasers or something that just isn't in the realm of what is done in these circumstances. I mean, I don't want to make it too ridiculous, but I share Judge Forrest's concern that what you're saying is not particularly reassuring, that, no, these are our menu options and this is what we're talking about. But you seem to be couching that against the background of this is the realm of possible. This is how you clear brush and trees.
Yes, Your Honor, I did not mean to overcomplicate the sort of the menu at option, you know, at issue here. And yes, certainly, like this is a resource management plan. You know, we have the environmental assessment that supports that plan, but that plan considers the specific options addressed here. That is the universe in which we live. And if BLM were to decide to take a different tact, or to amend its plan or to make another decision, that would be, you know, a different agency action. That would be a new agency action. In all likelihood, that would require additional NEPA in that case, depending on what the agency action is. So my hesitancy to sort of commit to any particular analysis is just because I don't know what form or, you know, a type of action that would take if it's an amendment to the watershed restoration plan, or, you know, how else it might take form. But certainly that could trigger additional NEPA here. But that is not something that's contemplated under this resource management plan or this watershed restoration plan. And, you know, I don't think is what this particular document or NEPA analysis is allowing. This sort of free for all, or, you know, choose whatever option, even other ones that are outside of this, and that's okay. Under no circumstances does this EA or watershed restoration project authorize such an approach. It only authorizes what it says it does. And I see I'm running out of time, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, I'd ask this court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, to start, I'd simply like to read from the record, and this is at 1 ER 33. All treatment methods would be available in all units and is not limited to preferred treatments described above. Plaintiffs have never argued that this EA authorizes things that are outside the scope of the EA. The problem is that in any particular place, as Judge Forrest and Judge Beatty mentioned, the entire universe or the entire menu of options could be applied at any time and in any combination. And that's the lack of structure that results in this decision not being reasonably explained. And I'll elaborate a little bit on what that means. The area is so vast and the analysis is so general that the EA rarely goes beyond stating the obvious when it comes to environmental impacts. And that's the real problem here, and that's what really runs afoul of this court's precedent. For example, on many subjects like wildlife and migratory birds, the EA says impacts could be from major and substantial to minor and negligible. That's the entire range of impacts. Major to negligible. So it's not conveying any useful information as to the nature or the magnitude of those impacts. And that's where the EA ends up falling short. I'd also observe that for most of the resources analyzed, the EA basically concludes that alternative B, which includes no ground disturbing treatments, would be the same as alternative A, which includes things like chaining and harrowing and mowing. And the EA's conclusions are often simply conclusory and self-evident and don't cite to any particular evidence. And I think that's really the issue here. You know, we've been discussing, and I was observing some of the arguments yesterday, that there's this ongoing issue of, like, what does it mean to reasonably explain something, as Seven County phrases it? And this court has been very clear that the agency at least needs to do more than state the obvious. The agency has to base its conclusions on evidence and explain why it thinks this is the best evidence. And plaintiffs aren't asking this court to really look under the hood and say, well, we think this evidence is better than that evidence. That's not what this case is about. This case is simply about the fact that the agency has to show its work, and it's that shown work that receives deference from the court. And the agency didn't do that here. I'd also like to mention that, you know, in terms of the ambiguity here and the broadness, my friend on the other side referred to reducing pinyon juniper encroachment. That's one of many objectives for this project. Again, this project basically throws the whole kitchen sink in there and says, we could do any of these things at any time. And again, we're not arguing that there's some alternative thing like lasers out there that it authorizes. That's not our argument. But the...
That's why I keep coming back to this, like, adaptive management concept generally, because it seems to me that for somebody who is concerned about the environmental consequences and preservation of an area, that you would want the government to be sort of taking incremental steps and re-looking at the environment if we're years down the road or if we've done a few things and just sort of see how they play out and then how they impact the unit next door or whatever. And that there's language in this EA that clearly indicates that that's part of the government structure, is to build in that, like, look, we're going to treat this unit first and then we're going to see what that treatment does to the one next door before we do the one next door and we might adjust. Like, that as a concept seems like a good thing, and yet most of your argument is, I want certainty. I want them to be pinned down on exactly what they're doing so I have notice. But don't those two things sort of work at cross purposes?
No, Your Honor. We don't object to the concept of adaptive management. Adaptive management can be useful. I see that I'm out of time, so would you like me to continue?
Yes,
please.
We don't object to the concept of adaptive management. The problem is that when you look at a project this big and this expansive, what we're looking for is some reasonable assurance that this actually will be beneficial. There's a lot in the record indicating that these kinds of treatments can do more harm than good, especially when it comes to sage grouse. There's a lot of sagebrush reduction in this project that my friend on the other side isn't talking about. Sagebrush reduction can be very harmful to sage grouse. So we just like the government to articulate its adaptive approach with some degree of specificity, not necessarily pin them down on every acre, but just articulate, like, how is the government going to ensure that this actually has some benefit? And we've discussed in our briefing a lot of the ways in which this doesn't do that. Not only does it not specify how and why the government's going to change its mind, but it doesn't address factors that the government itself is responsible for, like livestock grazing. So the objection is not to an adaptive approach. The objection is to a complete free-for-all, which this is. Any of these treatments described in the appendix of the EA could be done anywhere. There's no disputing that language is in the EA. And furthermore, the EA states no more NEPA will be done. No more examination will be done. So if the government chooses to go out and do a detailed examination of the results of its treatments, it can, but it's not required to. And it's certainly not required to disclose the outcome of that to the affected public, including our members, so we can understand what's happening on the lands in which we recreate and enjoy. So the basic point here is that the NEPA's fundamental purpose is to inform. I would argue that this EA, due to its inappropriate scope and its extreme generality and flexibility, confuses more than it informs. And that's why this decision is arbitrary and capricious. Unless this court has any other questions, I will conclude.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments this morning. They were very helpful. And this case is submitted, and we are adjourned until tomorrow morning.